because
is the most, McLuhan used to point that out, the one with the most definitions, the longest entry is SET, set.
Yeah.
What were you saying, Roxy? I think Roxy was trying to say something there.
Yes, that I am started talking about economy, which is like the less spiritual. But then he said,
but no, Roxy, look at the, hold it. The first thing he talked about, before we knew it was Ion, the first minute when I didn't even know what was happening, he started talking about the most esoteric medium. You know what that is? The fucking Resolute desk in the White House and in and Buckingham Palace. That was the first thing he started talking about. The most esoteric, weird communication that Reagan and the Queen used. Okay, what were you going to say?
Yes, that money was an expression of your power. And, yes, most
did you say was or was it not? What did you say?
Is an expression of your power.
Okay.
What you
right.
can manifest.
But you have to understand what it is. You can't be all emotionally fucked up about it to make it work for you.
But all these resets and revolutions could not work because there was these hidden changes that nobody was aware of that were already happening with the different media.
Yeah.
Like the dissolution of the Gulf with the electric environment.
Right.
And we had to reset a lot to really bring these changes forth, to change the atmosphere and do all these changes. Because in the French Revolution, the American Revolution, another revolution, the Soviet Revolution, the Mexican Revolution, nothing really changed.
Right.
Because it's not about changing.
You know what changed? The social mortar changed. Roxy, the social mortar changed. Revolutions were attempts to project certain tribal values into the new effects of whatever the media was. And it always ended up in a war. And so there was change in the world of language, but not the way humans thought. They didn't get any peace and love. They would never get that.
Yeah, so
now,
dropping,
Roxy,
dropping out or... Yeah.
Yeah, like Kathy Griffin. The Android meme broke me. Every revolutionary, Trotsky, Gorbachev, they all got broken. And they admit it. So, but here's what Roxy, we have to give her credit. She came up with a new phrase. You got make America great again. And then Macron answers with make the planet great again. So Roxy says make our blood great again.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I like that a lot. That
yes, and on that paper, you play this session with Diane in which he's explaining alignment.
Yes.
That he tells you, make this line, and this is like, we have to realign. And this is the tuning in.
Yes.
But he doesn't mean it like the Abrahams, 1, 2, 3. He said it backwards. You 3, 2, 1. That's how you realign. You don't try to match. You actually have to allow your tactility to come through. So you relax and allow. And let your perceptions of tactility mature. You don't do it by matching. Which is what most people think realign is. They try to get visual balance. You can't get visual balance today. Is a different kind of balance, which includes disruption.
This
contrast.
And, this balance to the new frequency is what we all do. I've been explaining how it's about all these thresholds that
right. The frequency thresholds. So you take the drops to adapt your blood to the frequency change in the surround, the new surround. Now, I want to play something. I notice on the side it says Howard Stern talks about the Zappa family feud. 4 minutes. We got to hear that.
Before, Before you play that, I sent you an app.
Another one?
In which, yeah, Frank Zappa is promoting the White Album of the Beatles.
Okay. All right, we'll play
that. That's an Zappa app.
Now, is this done by the guy who does the albums, or who does this? Zap himself?
Zappa.
Okay.
I don't know why. I thought maybe you would know.
No, I've never heard of this. Let's see what it is. It's 6 minutes.
The Beatles from Apple Records, now discounted and on sale at the Music Hall, 8878 Sunset Boulevard.
Why don't we do it in the road?
This album consists of two long-playing plastic discs, black in color and drew to accommodate approximately 30 new songs. Each disc sports a clever hole centered equidistant from all its edges and placed well within a large green paper apple on the label, which, when placed on a revolving turntable, will spin in a clockwise direction and emit its best sounds at 33 and a third revolutions per minute. The Beatles. Both discs will be presented to you, the great buying public, in two paper protective sheets, which will be placed inside the cardboard lease of a jacket, designed to be as visually appealing as possible. The entire package will be wrapped in soft, transparent, blood-like plastic to read to your listeners, record store lights. The Beatles, now at the Music Hall. Buy it today and do it in the road.
Hey, that's now at the Music Hall, the brand new Beatle album on special sale discount. And the Music Hall, of course, is right across the street from the Whiskey on the Sunset Strip.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Just let me hear some of that rock and roll revolution. Just let me hear some of that music revolution.
The brand new Beatles double album, on sale now at Music Revolution, 8709 Santa Monica Boulevard, three blocks west of La Cienega in Hollywood. Help support the revolution.
Music Revolution.
And now, the live tag number two to follow-up tape number two. The brand new Beatle album, which lists for $11.98, is now on sale for the low price of $6.98 at Music Revolution. God, are they doing you a favor? Don't forget that for a limited time only, all 479 LPs are $268 at Music Revolution, including the new Rolling Stones LP, Beggar's Banquet, and the new Judy Collins LP. Wonderful. Let's hear it for them.
That was real good, except you made one mistake.
What's that?
Instead of saying low price, you're supposed to repeat low about four times. You're supposed to say low, 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 low price.
They're giving it to you cheap. Boy, listen, it's amazing that the Beatles have to do a commercial. You know, that's ferocious. You know, come on, you guys, help the Beatles. Buy their record. Buy the Beatles record. Come on.
You're listening to KPPC. It's 106.7 on your FM dial. Music is happening 24 hours a day. Today.
Sergeant Pepper was a real guy with a fire for the thing. don't you come out? You were only waiting for this moment to arrive. You were only waiting for this moment to arrive. Seen the little piggies crawling in the dirt, and for all the little piggies, life is getting worse. So won't you please come home, come, come back to me, honey pie.
So these are clips from the radio of that era, Christmas 68. That's what's happening here? With Zappa on the radio, KPBC. He was a guest.
I suppose he did some ads. Because
I don't know if he did these. Well, he's on the radio, KPBC, which is an L.A. station, and he's hearing the ads, so he's just commenting on the ads, making fun of them, saying, why would the Beatles have to make a commercial? I don't think he's editing this stuff. It's just something he heard, and he had his cynical comment immediately.
Yeah, and even while he's talking, you can hear the like sarcasm in his voice.
Yeah.
He can't quite get out of there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So that was a good find. I've never heard that before, Roxy. That's pretty good. Let's see now. Let's go back to now Howard Stern. He interviewed Dweezil, Moon. He liked them. He was a family friend. So that's very. He is a guy qualified to have an opinion on this, or he would be affected by it because he knew the people involved. So let's hear what he has to say. Before I start, I'm gonna mute everybody. Just people are leaking through. Where is that?
Yes, I'm going to the toilet just in case.
Okay, we will not look. We will not watch.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Okay, so unmute all.
All participants are now muted.
So are you going to hear this, Roxy? You keeping the phone with you?
Have you ever heard of Fidget?
Beg your pardon?
Yeah.
I think she has to... I don't know if she can mute. Like she's on the line. Anyway, she looks like she's muted. Okay. So let's hear what he says. Howard Stern.
You know, I was reading in the paper when we were on vacation that the Zappa kids are fighting. You got Frank Zappa, great guy. His
and
wife,
those kids always seem to get along.
Yeah, there was Dweezil Moon Unit, Amit. I'm in touch with Amit. And I think there's another kid in that whole thing.
There's a daughter.
A daughter, right? What's her
that
name?
That we don't know?
I can't remember the name now.
Diva, right. Thank you, Benji. Diva. And so Gail Zappa died, and then there was an estate that split between all the kids.
I didn't know that Gail had died.
Yeah, and Dweezil used to go out and play under the name Zappa Play Zappa. He'd play his father's music. This is what I read, by the way. If I have it wrong, I have it wrong. But evidently, this caused some kind of rift between the kids and the estate, because the estate is saying you can't call it Zappa. Zappa Play Zappa. You're using Frank's name, and therefore Dweezil had to pay the estate in order to use the name Zappa Play Zappa. And so you can imagine this caused a big rift. And I don't think Ahmet and Dweezil talk anymore.
Wow.
And it made me sad. It was like, oh, Frank knew this. He would say, Howard, you get those boys in a room and you fucking work this out.
Howard, I read the article. It says they just talked to lawyers now. Ahmet, by the way, is going to be on the wrap-up show on Thursday.
Never mind the wrap-up show.
Why would they take that step, Howard? What could be the problem?
I don't know, other than unless they weren't happy with the performance and the use of Frank's pictures. And so they said, what do you got? You got info?
I read the article, too.
Yeah, well.
He said that even when his mother was alive,
right,
she charged him an exorbitant fee to use the name. But now they wanted to charge him a bigger fee. I couldn't fully understand it. They said it was almost as if you're putting on a play, so that you got to charge a fee that's way bigger than just a performance.
But Frank would be rolling in his grave
if he knew that
Dweezil wanted to honor him with this. But maybe the estate, meaning Ahmet and the other two kids, don't feel Dweezil's doing a good job or something?
They say that Ahmet and Diva are running the estate, and that Dweezil and Moon aren't really their trustees, but they're not part of the people who are running it.
And who left that in charge? Gail? Did she leave two of the kids in charge and two out? That's a big mistake.
It was unclear whether... See, it was really unclear whether two are running it because they just are, because they're all trustees.
But I think it's so beautiful that a son would go out and play his father's music.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, it seems sad to me. Those guys,
it seems a shame that a son can't get the permission to play his father's music.
I don't know. I just hate that they're not getting along.
I agree.
I like those kids. And I loved Frank.
I thought the same thing as you. I thought Frank would be horrified.
Yeah.
He's sort of a peaceful dude.
Frank would want that. I know, because Frank speaks to me at night, actually. You know how Jerry Falwell and those guys speak to God?
You speak to Frank Zappa?
I do, and it's a lot more satisfying. He told me the Pope smokes dope or something like that. No, I mean, seriously, he would freak the fuck out if he knew his kids were at each other's throats.
Well, it's very deep. Dweezil also revealed his intention to stop using images of his father at the show.
Yeah, because he was told not to.
Stop selling merchandise.
Oh, see, now you might have hit into something.
Ahmet says, I'm not standing in the way of Dweezil playing the music.
Yeah.
He would just have to be in accordance with the family trust, which means you have to be in accord with him because he runs it.
Yeah. But I wonder what I just seem to feel if I got the two kids on the show and I sat them down, you know how wonderful I am with children.
Well, what is the trust trying to preserve?
Well, I could work that out.
Dweezil might be infringing upon. That is the question.
Okay, so we just heard a pale version of me. He fucking talks about talking to Frank, and I actually fucking do it, right? But wait a minute, I muted everybody. Sorry. I can't mute people in the bathroom.
Nobody has anything to say? What?
Who's that? Who just said that?
That's me. That's Brian.
Oh, yeah, Brian's on the other line. I got two people on the phone here, right. Yeah. Okay.
All participants are now unmuted.
Agree with me. He claims as a joke, this is the anti-Trump comedian obsolescent, he claims he can talk to Frank at night. I can do it literally, right? Then he says he could fix up the kids. I could fix up these kids if I was in there better than he could. We could give them the fucking drops. Then they'd calm down, right?
Yeah.
So this reminds me of my interview with Craig Pincus, which got no publicity. None of you fuckers even know what happened. It didn't promote it at all. You almost all got fired because you didn't promote it. You don't even know what I'm talking about. So, Craig Pincus...
Really, we're not fuckers. We're mortars.
You're what? Mortars? What'd she say?
Mothers.
Mothers. Mothers.
Mothers, right. Very good. That's right. You're all black women. Like all of us. We're all black women. Motherfuckers. So, the first fan letter of Zappa was put out by this lawyer in Minneapolis or someplace named Craig Pincus in like 70, 71. So I heard about it and I subscribed to it. And I probably back then had to write to the guy. So we had a little bit of personal communication. But he would analyze Just Another Band from L.A. That's 71, so I know he did that. So he was an intellectual guy analyzing Frank and pointing out what people hadn't realized about Frank yet. So he was an early educated Zappa fan. Well, Zappa liked what he did, and they became really good friends. And Zappa got him into the music industry, because Zappa was dealing with other musicians when legal issues came up. He said, well, I got a smart guy here. Let's have Craig work for you. So Craig built up this lucrative business in the music world, I guess the celebrity world, because Frank introduced him to it. So a few years ago, I thought, no one ever talks about Craig Pincus. The only guy I knew about Craig Pincus was David Wally, who probably quotes Craig Pincus in his book, which was written at that time, so Wally would know about Craig Pincus, probably met him. I think they became friends. I never met Craig Pincus, but I corresponded with him. So no one since Wally, 45 years ago, talks about Craig Pincus. So I'm thinking a few years ago, let's find out what Craig thinks about what's going on. This is before Gail died. So I asked him to do an interview, and he says he won't because he's bound to Gail as a friend. I would have to ask Gail, he said, for permission to interview him. So he's totally loyal to Gail, and that also meant Frank. So I got Gail's lawyer email and wrote her and asked her if I could interview Craig Pincus. This would be in early 2015, and she never responded. And the lawyer apologized, but he didn't say why she wouldn't respond. The lawyer was the go-between. I had to send emails through him. So then Gail dies after she meets me, October 6th and 7th, 2014. If you meet me and you're not synced in, you die. So a year later, on the same fucking day, October 7th, she dies. Okay, so I call up Craig Pincus, say, okay, now can we – now? Well, first of all, I realize, oh, that's why she wouldn't respond to me, wouldn't even think about it, because she was dying. She was sick. So now I call up Craig Pincus. I said, okay, can you do an interview now? Now that you're not obligated to Gail, she ain't around, you can do something. He says, okay. So I do this interview, and we get into a big chunk of it near the end about, as a lawyer for famous musician families, he says this is a very common scene. The kids, they have powerful parents, or one parent's really powerful, they fucking get all fucked up in their core personality or being when the parent dies. And he says this is really regular. The kids arguing over the estate and fucking up like Zappa kids, because that's normal among the offspring of geniuses. And he said, you know, Gail was a strong personality too. So you have two strong parents, and the kids are vulnerable. I don't know if I agree with him, but he went into this in quite detail, citing examples. Well, unfortunately, when I went upstairs during the dialogue, the phone disconnected. I didn't know it, so that part never got recorded. So an hour-long interview is only technically, content-wise, like 35 minutes or 45 minutes or something. So I told him that it fucked up, but someday I'd like him to go over it again, and we'll get it on record. Because he was giving interesting advice about the situation, even as a lawyer. And so I haven't done that yet. We have to see what to do, when to get him to redo it. And maybe it's better now because more has happened. So I think I want to play a bit of that interview, because his relationship with Frank was totally on another level than most people. Cool. It was like they would discuss ideas. It was an intellectual relationship. And Frank was not Frank the public cynic with Greg. They were really good friends. So let's see if I can bring that up. You tolerate this for a few minutes?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I got to go over to Ian and Bob because I posted Bill Ed posted it on Ian and Bob, but no one ever commented. I don't think anybody saw it. So let's see, where is that? This probably came out right when you guys were worried about Trump winning. That's probably when the date of the interview. So nobody was paying attention to anything else but the election. So there it is. Bob talks with Craig Pincus, longtime close friend of Frank and Gail Zappa. What's the date? Well, I must give it on the thing. There's no date here. So here we go. Oh, no, I'm muting everybody. Just a second. Okay, this is Friday, June 24th, 2016, and I'm on the phone with... Oh, stop it. June 2016, that's right in the middle of Trump blowing it. You know what I mean? It's before the convention. People still don't take him seriously. So you could say that was quite heavy distraction. So that's my alibi that you guys didn't know about it.
All participants are now muted.
The Trump phenomenon. So let me just rewind it and start again. Okay, this is Friday, June 24th, 2016, and I'm on the phone with Mr. Craig Pincus, a lawyer in Indianapolis. I became aware of Craig Pincus in 1970 or 71. I was living in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and I started to get Craig's Zappa fan letter idea. It wasn't just a fan letter. It had all kinds of interesting ideas in it, reviewing albums and stuff, and that was in 70, 71, and I don't think I ever spoke to Mr. Pincus back then, but he may have corresponded a bit. Now, what I remember, Craig, was you reviewing just another band from L.A. and talking about how people were suppressing hearing what Zappa was really singing about. You brought in the idea that he was talking and addressing people's subconscious or what they didn't want to be conscious of. And there was a lot of repression, I guess that's the word you used, going on in responding to Frank's work. That was probably the first time I ever heard anybody say that about Frank. And it's probably true, but do you recall saying those kind of things?
Excuse me just a second. I've got to respond to something.
Okay, it's all right.
Okay, I'm with you. Sorry.
Okay, I just want to add that Craig's newsletter, fan letter, was called Mother's Home Journal. And I think you told me that Frank named it that?
He did, yes. We discussed the idea in advance of the first issue, and I sent him a little logo I created for it, which I applied with a rubber stamp. Had a rubber stamp made in the design, and had a couple of ideas about names. And Frank said, "Call it Mother's Home Journal," and that is what it was called.
Right. So before I go back to a little point before this, I just asked you, do you remember me? Remember those ideas about just another band from L.A. being showing or people. Not really hearing what Frank was talking about, and a lot of repression going on, a denial. Do you remember saying that idea?
Well, do I specifically remember writing it or saying it? What was this, 1971?
Yeah, thinking it, say. Remember thinking
huh?
It. You remember thinking it?
Oh,
least.
Sure, of course.
Right,
I mean,
right.
That's obviously true of Frank and all kinds of other artists whose work is significant on several levels simultaneously, has many meetings simultaneously.
Right. Okay.
You know, an idea exhaustively considered, at least in Shakespeare scholarship and countless artists since.
Did you say you noticed that? Is that what you just said? In countless artists?
Oh, of course.
All right.
Oh, of course.
Okay, so let's...
Yeah. I mean, for example, Flo and Eddie...
Yes.
...have just been commenting about their new box set that they're going to issue. And Mark Volman is quoted within the last day or two about how actually their simplistic sounding songs had foundational ideas that were political and had some edge and reflected the times, and they were saying something serious, but it was obviously very sugar-coated. And with Frank, of course, that was even more profoundly true of all kinds of his things.
So what, you're bringing this up about their career in the Turtles. I mean, are they overreaching when they're saying that, or are you giving them the credit, the benefit of the doubt there? Turtle, Happy Together and whatever other songs they did, you're saying,
right.
You're saying they're exaggerating?
No, I mean, I take... Mark Volman's a very smart guy, and I know that firsthand, yes. And I have no reason to disbelieve what he says. I mean, the creative process is so often different than what the recipients of the product imagine.
Yes.
That's a commonplace story.
Okay.
So I wrote this because of that. I was thinking this, and, you know, the world
right.
has no idea.
Okay, so that means you knew Frank for how long before you started the Mother's Home Journal? Like a year or two?
I'd say a couple of years we were communicating, yeah.
Did you, like myself, enter into awareness of Frank through Freakout first?
I think I don't date my awareness to an album.
Hmm.
Frank's influence was in the air. I was going to law school in Cambridge, and Bob Dylan was performing in local coffee shops, and a great deal of the most influential music to come out of the mid-60s and, you know, blossom later was in the air, and Frank was in the air. I do remember my first copy of Freakout I acquired by accident. And that is unexpected. I mean, in the days of vinyl mass production, mistakes were made. So I bought an album by another artist, and I opened the cellophane, and out came Freakout, which was in the wrong cover.
Did you ever read Susie Rotolo's book on her life with Bob Dylan?
No.
Because she talks about the scene in Cambridge. You're talking about up near Boston, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So you were there. So that means you were born in the early 40s?
1943.
Almost Frank's age. So,
a little bit younger.
Right. So you were responding to the folk scene before Frank came into your awareness?
No, I was aware of it. I didn't think it was musically very interesting. And still don't. My musical roots, as a pre-teenager in Indianapolis, Indiana, are very specific. The Indianapolis area was featuring a jazz scene of some significance. I was more or less self-taught drummer with a with almost no equipment, but somehow or another, a boyhood friend of mine and I stumbled onto a man whose name was Sonny Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And Sonny Johnson was a drummer, and Sonny Johnson said he would give us drum lessons for free, and that was the right price. We walked or hitchhiked to his house when we could. There was no regular schedule. And every once in a while, Sonny Johnson would say, stick around, because members of the band he was playing with would be coming to his residence to rehearse. And so I sat on the floor at the age of 12 and watched this little group rehearse. And in this little group were the Montgomery brothers, including Wes Montgomery.
Wow.
Yeah, and so jazz was my mother tongue, and obviously it was important to Frank as well, although he maybe is not discussed, did not discuss it as broadly as other influences, but
yes.
The complexity of the music impressed me as a kid, and we continued to have a wonderful jazz scene in Indianapolis, which I could only participate inadvertently or, you know, when something happened to be free.
Yeah.
But we had great artists here, and some, a few still survive, but, you know, we had Freddie Hubbard and on and on and on.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of great artists. So that interest in and that interest in what I'll call complex music also influenced me. There was a great deal of symphonic and operatic music in a collection of 45s that my father had, and I would listen to that. And so while I love beautiful, simple, melodic lines, I've always been drawn in most to complex music. And a guy with a harmonica sitting on a stool and maybe a guitar, too, didn't get me.
How old would be Sonny Johnson in that period?
When Sonny was teaching us, he would have been maybe very early 30s.
Okay, so relatively young.
And the jazz scene was, life worked differently. The ability to travel was limited. And even after Wes Montgomery became a world figure in music, he would not fly.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, the ubiquity, the physical presence of artists was, comparatively rare event. They stuck mostly around here.
Yeah. In high school and that, did you listen to doo-wop or any of the 50s music that would be part of your life?
I thought it was an object of ridicule, and I thought the music often categorized as bubblegum was offensive.
You know, I've met many. I knew a music professor in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and he was an American. And this would be in the 70s, and I would talk to him about Zappa, but he would say, I was not ready for what Frank was combining, because as a teenager, I was into jazz. I've met many people your generation who, once they got into jazz, they didn't respond to teen music at all. You know what I mean? It
was like, yes, but I was broader than that. Frank, of course, loved all kinds of classical music, especially 20th century. I remember one night when I was on the road with him, and we sat, and he had some of the earliest editions of miniaturized speakers. We listened to a recording of Stravinsky's Aegon. And I'd been listening to Stravinsky since about the same era, 11 or 12 years old. And his love of Edgard Varèse and other significant composers of the mid-20th century, I shared that as well. There was a lot of musical vocabulary, and the least experience I had was with the Pachuco culture in L.A. and environs that obviously influenced him quite a bit, too.
Right. So how did you first meet Frank? Did you seek him out, or did you bump into each other?
Yeah, I did. I first met him and talked to him backstage at a concert in Indianapolis shortly after I was practicing law. I began practicing law in 1968, and the concert was here at the Indianapolis Fairgrounds Coliseum, which was one of the only venues that had some size. And Gail was there, being a lawyer and being a little more glib, I think, than ordinary fans, I just talked myself into the backstage, and the backstage was really not a backstage at all. The Coliseum is a place it's a show ring, essentially, for horseback riding and judging animals and things like that. And the backstage area was nothing more than a public corridor, but it was cordoned off with a couple of security people. We talked for a while, and then I started becoming aware of other fans whose musical interest was, I'll say, a little more than superficial. One of them was Vaughn Wiester, a trombone player from Columbus, Ohio, who went on to do some big band things. And I got to talk to Frank at a few concerts for a little while, but one day Vaughn Wiester got in touch with me. He probably wrote a letter. The subject was he read the Warner Circular.
Yes, that'd be 1971, right?
Yeah. He read in the Warner Circular that a guy named David Wally was writing a book about Frank and needed bibliography or other kinds of more or less scholarly content.
Yes.
Or at least more serious content than gossip. And so he said, get in touch with the guy, which I did. And that led to a lot of continuing dialogue with Frank, which led Frank to invite me out. And he was living in Laurel Canyon still. So I went out for a week.
But let me just interrupt you there. You're saying that you got in touch with Dave Wally?
Uh-huh, yeah. I did the bibliography for the first edition of No Commercial Potential.
Wow, I was a proofreader of it. I met him in 70 or 71 when he was writing for the East Village Other, same time as I guess you did. And I stayed at his place in November 71 at the premiere for 200 Motels, and he was very upset because he and Frank were starting to have a falling out over the book.
Oh, yeah.
So I heard him commiserate about that, and I read the book. I read whatever the manuscript was at that point. Mm-hmm. So we both were involved with Dave Wally at the same time. That's amazing. I had visited Don Van Vliet in the summer of 71 up in Ben Lomond, California, and when he didn't know Dave Wally or anything, but when I told him that Wally was doing a book on Frank, he got a little mad. Now, this is when he was irritated by Frank, and he says, why would anybody write a book on Frank? Granted, he's a good engineer, but, geez, he's not an artist or anything worth writing about. Let me get in touch with this guy. So I put Beefheart in touch with Wally, and I guess that's how he got into the book. I don't remember your name. Was your name mentioned in the book? Are you quoted?
Oh, sure it is. The bibliography at the back
okay.
probably wasn't part of what you read.
Right. So
I have a copy sitting in my office.
Right. So
Dave autographed that one, and then when the more recent edition was issued, we talked, and he sent me that and said thanks for the first round. By that time, of course, the internet world existed, and there
right.
the ability to accumulate citations of material on Frank was vastly different. Mine was all clip and paste, you know.
Right. So did you get to hear Dave's complaints about Frank or Frank's complaints about Dave in the middle of that in 71, 72 when they were trying to get the book out?
Frank spoke very briefly about Dave Wally, and actually Gail was probably more unhappy with him.
Mm.
David and I talked a few times, but I mean, it's not like we were close. I never met him in person. We always just talked on the phone and corresponded. And I thought he was a very funny person. I also, in my small way, tried to gentle down some of the harsh things that tended to get said.
So you were a bit of a mediator, but Frank, it was more talking to David than Frank. He only spoke once, you're saying, with Frank, but about David. But did you talk a bit about...
Frank didn't dwell on that at all.
Did you talk to Gail about it more?
I might have heard a sentence or two that was unflattering and nothing more.
Right. I know Frank...
Never had a conversation that I can remember.
Right. I remember Frank saying later, I don't know, a couple of years later, he said what he thought was a problem with David is David was projecting on him maybe a father figure, and he said, I was forced to treat him like a psychiatric patient. That's what Frank said. And, of course, that wasn't what Dave Wally thought he was doing, and he was very upset about that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's interesting. What did you say in your first meeting with Frank? What did you discuss? Did you have genuine questions you wanted to ask him about what he was doing, or did you just want to impress him with what you knew? How did you?
You mean when I talked to him backstage the first time?
The first time, yeah. What did you begin with? What topic?
I couldn't tell you. I don't have any idea.
So he didn't ask you to hang around or anything, but you met him a few times after that, and then he started to notice you.
Yeah, and we just started conversing, and the kind of conversations we had were a little bit of a change of pace from his standard fan conversations.
Right.
And we talked about the world beyond music and the world beyond what he was doing, and we shared an interest in a lot of topics, and so the conversations were a little bit more far-ranging.
Yeah. Did you ever hear him talking at that period, 71, 72, 73, about running for president? You remember he had the idea of the interested party?
Not seriously. I don't remember any serious comments.
Well, I think in 68...
There were bumper stickers.
Yes. But in 68, he was talking about his interested party. That's what he called it. And he was talking about Tom Wilson being the candidate for the interested party. But we wouldn't put much into that, except that when I talked to Cal Schenkel years ago, he told me that Frank would talk about being president as something he would try to do years later. Cal Schenkel actually had conversations in 68, 69 about that. So that, to me, knowing that, wondered if he had talked to you about it, because he was thinking it that early. But you don't...
Go ahead. Discuss political matters.
Right. Did you think... not knowing your political education, did you find Frank naive about the democracy, or cynical, or educated, or was he just a guy who had a sense of civilian responsibility? What, how would you say his political interests came across to you?
As of when?
In the early 70s, when you first were talking to him about the world.
Well, the nothing stands out other than we didn't have to discuss very much what we thought about Richard Nixon.
Yeah, right.
There was an understanding about his role in the universe.
Was Frank cynical? Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, was Frank cynical about the Democratic Party at that point? Like McGovern?
I know very few subjects that Frank was not cynical about. Serious comment.
Is there any topic he wasn't cynical about that you can think of? Maybe his own music.
Frank had genuine friendships and relationships and his kids and they, you know, about people. There were people that he was not even remotely cynical about, who had earned his trust, but his trust wasn't easily granted. And the his own family, of course, was very important, and so the thing that Frank was generally cynical about, this is a commonplace observation, was what was motivating people who were seeking attention, who were trying to develop an audience, who were trying to be heard, what was motivating them, and what was motivating a fan who was trying to get his attention. Mm-hmm. And so on and so on and so on. And he had a great respect for how crazy people can be and how dangerously crazy people can be.
Right. So how soon did he get you interested in being a musical lawyer or a lawyer in the music industry?
Never. He never had anything to do with it. He was a completely... unintended influencer, in the sense that the first client that developed into a large and multi-decade client called me up when, at the same venue that Frank was performing at, they were going to promote their second conference, and the manager of the venue, who's a employee of the state of Indiana, the Indiana State Fairgrounds is owned by the Indiana government, and this manager said that they could not book the venue unless he got a third of the profits, and they were looking for a lawyer to find out if that was lawful. And they called me up. I remember quite vividly. It was a Sunday. They called me up, and they were calling me up because they'd heard I was a friend of Frank's. And I'd had some parties for Frank when he performed here. And again, this was around 71. And I started representing these people in late 71, early 72, and represented them for next 40 some years. They only had heard about it. It had nothing to do with Frank. Frank did want me to be directly involved with him, And at one point I did assist on some things, but he wanted me to involved in a much larger way. And, that's a memorable episode. It was a very difficult decision.
Okay, maybe you will talk address that in a minute, but why would your awareness of Zappa interest the people at the state fair? What's the connection there?
It didn't interest people at the state fair. It was of interest to a pair of concert promoters.
Oh, okay.
Who had just gotten into the business of promoting concerts, and they had one, and it was successful. And one show, it was Isaac Hayes, Hot Buttered Soul era.
Yeah.
And they were about to do their second show at the same venue when they were told they would have to cut the venue manager in for a share of the profits. And they didn't think that was right and wanted a lawyer.
And so,
they thought I knew something about the concert industry because of my friendship with Frank. That's why they called me up.
Did you know anything about the concert industry?
Of course not.
Okay, so that's around...
But that was pretty easy to figure out.
Right. What was it legal? What the manager was...
Oh, well, how does a public employee decide to cut themselves in for a percentage of profit on a rental of a state facility?
Right, right. That's right.
No, that's...
So you won the case for them?
What?
You won the case, or...
There was no case. That went away instantly. All it took was a couple of phone calls.
Right. Okay, so that's... is that 71, 72?
Yep.
Okay, so you meet Frank around 68, did you say? 68, 69.
Yes.
And you're already a good buddy by 71, and he's inviting you out to when do you first go to his place? That would be Woodrow Wilson Drive in 71, 72, if that's
when. That's it. '70 or '71, I think it's the first time I spent time there. And then I started going out on the road after that.
And can you go into what was the larger position he hoped you wouldn't engage with him?
Don't understand the way you're asking that.
Well, you're saying that he wanted you to help him a bit, but then he wanted you to get more involved. And
yes, he did. Yes, it's not something I've talked about, but in late 1972, early 1973, Frank fired Herbie Cohen and asked me to take over.
And you were tempted. You're saying it was a hard decision.
Well, it was an easy decision. It was a painful decision, but it was easy. I had a six-month-old son, which I told Frank. He said, I want you here tomorrow. And I said, Frank, I've got a six-month-old baby. One of the great ironies of my life is that that baby, whose name was Aaron Zappa Bennett Pincus, grew up and with the clients that I mentioned to you, first got in contact with me about the shakedown at the state fairground.
Yeah.
We developed venues, and one of the venues was originally called Deer Creek Amphitheater in north side of Indianapolis. It has been enormously successful, the place provided summer jobs for my eldest, and through that he met various people in the music business. He was a gopher. That led him to helping out John Mellencamp, who, of course, is an Indiana native, but doing things for